All right, good afternoon, everyone. Lights keep going on and off. Happens, okay. So, following up from last time, by popular request, I want to discuss conservative Judaism and what it's about, what the movement is about, analyze the history and the philosophy. And it's not intended, of course, just like last time, to marginalize anyone or degrade or disparage, not to bury or to praise, but just to understand how it came into being. And it's not at all a comment on whether or not conservative Jews or self-identified conservative Jews are Jews. Of course they're Jews if they're born of a Jewish mother or converted according to halacha. The latter point is a sticking point, but most are born of a Jewish mother, therefore they're Jews. I mentioned that at the outset because preparing, I went through some of my archives and I came across, I actually lived through all of this. This is an article, you see the headline from 1997, Orthodox Rabbis Say Non-Orthodox Are Not Jews. Okay? Now, this was in response to a statement of the Agudas HaRabbanim that said that the Agudas HaRabbanim hereby declares Reform and Conservative Judaism are not Judaism at all. Their adherents are Jews according to Jewish law, but their religion is not Judaism. Notwithstanding that paragraph, this guy writes an op-ed in the Times saying how dare they say he's not Jewish. And there are dozens of articles across the country back then with this accusation. The OU and the RCA, to their discredit, issued a statement basically repudiating the Agudas HaRabbanim, saying that they should not have said what they said. It's very divisive. That generated a letter from me to the RCA, so I was dismayed by their repudiation, because all they did was question not the identity of the Jews, but the validity of the movements. Anyway, there's no end, because it's a popular fundraising tool to claim in the non-Orthodox world that we see them as not Jewish. This headline, by the way, Orthodox Rabbis Say Non-Orthodox Are Not Jews, gave rise to this correction a few days later. For the record, the headline mischaracterized the declaration. They said that the movements are not Jewish. The declaration refers to the movements, not their adherents. But nonetheless, that is pretty much par for the course. What's that?
You said that was
yes, it was like a staple every Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur where they had the largest, look, the Orthodox are saying we're not Jews, we have to defend ourselves. No one ever said they're not Jews. It's for an Orthodox, anybody to say they're not Jews would be a denial of the Torah, because the Torah says they are Jews. So. What's that?
If you interpret Rashi a certain way, it could seem to be that more than just Jewish lineage is
Yisrael apishachata Yisrael. Even a sinning Jew is considered a Jew. So what are we talking about? It's pretty obvious. What's that?
I love how they're able to use that as a fundraising opportunity.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, happens every year. The conversion issue is a big fundraising tool as well. Now, conservative Judaism is, and I'll just use the term because that's the term they use, is essentially an American institution with very traceable European roots. And to a large extent, it was and remains a reaction against both Reform and Orthodoxy. Reform Judaism perceived as rejecting halacha, the Orthodox perceived as too tenaciously clinging to halacha, and so conservative Judaism adopts for itself the middle ground. So there's a stereotype that's existed for a century, existed when I was a child also. That's a simple way we looked at the world, that conservative Judaism, it's like in the middle. It's in the middle. It's not as religious as the Orthodox. It's not as rejectionist as Reform. It's a stereotype that we'd be hard-pressed to disprove, because, in fact, it sees itself as a synthesis, as a hybrid. And I think the common assumption is more or less accurate, all protestations of the contrary notwithstanding. Nonetheless, as time has developed, certainly last decade or two, the conservative movement and its adherents have become much more aligned in many ways with Reform, to the extent that is almost indistinguishable between the Reform and conservative Jew. not many occupy themselves or preoccupy themselves with the ideology of the movements, but they just identify with those movements. So we started last time with Reform Judaism because it's just easier to analyze and to classify. They denied Torah Min HaShemayim, they denied Halacha, they denied a traditional understanding of Jewish life, and they adopted what they called prophetic Judaism, just the ideals of the prophets to the exclusion of the mitzvahs. When it came to the United States, what's that? Tikkun Olam came later, right. In the United States, the ideals of America and Judaism were the same, and so it was a natural blend. Conservative Judaism was always a little harder to analyze because its philosophy and tenets were in flux, and it's difficult to pin down, and objective standards much harder to find. But here's the irony. Today, they're both quite similar, the Reform and Conservative. Their adherents are almost interchangeable, and they make common cause in Israel. So you heard last week, someone pointed out to me, this young gentleman here, I wrote an article for Rut Sheva, came out I think last night, that the High Court of Justice approved Reform and Conservative non-Orthodox conversions in Israel for the purpose of Jewish status as citizens. But the irony is that in America, Conservative Judaism does not accept Reform conversions, because Reform conversions, such as they ever take place, don't adhere at all to Halacha. There's no tefillah, there's no milah, there's no Kabbalah Samitzos, there's nothing. So they, the conservatives, don't accept it. So why in Israel would they be advocating that Israel should accept it for status or for any other purpose when they themselves don't accept it? Well, we have to understand how all this came about and why it's almost a natural progression. Really, the spiritual father of conservative Judaism, although he had nothing to do with it technically, was a Jew named Zacharia Frankel, who was a Talmud of Bezalel of Ransburg, born in Prague, and he founded what became known as the Breslau Seminary. You should know, before we get to that, that he himself attended a Reform Jewish rabbinical conference in Breslau that we discussed last time, and he walked out. And he said that Reform Judaism has as little to do with Judaism as with any other religion. So what are its origins? How does it differ from Reform or Orthodoxy? What about it is against the Torah? What are its basic principles? And how were they formulated? So I think its origin comes in an institution, it's an ideological origin, an institution founded in 1819 by Leopold Zuntz in Europe, a bit of a maskil, called the Wissenschaft des Judentums, meaning the science of Judaism. And they began to look at Judaism almost as anthropology. And they use critical methodology to analyze the personalities and institutions of ancient Jewish life and to demonstrate the changes, the development that took place in Judaism. So they challenged ideas like the authorship of the Torah, like the authorship of the Talmud, and over time, ultimately, they denied the binding nature of Halacha. They saw Judaism really as a museum piece, something they would dissect and look to it as and see how it evolved into what it was today. So they didn't really have that many adherents at first, but their philosophy took root. The Reform adopted it, even though Zuntz himself said that Reform, he called it secret or open Christianity. So they cooperated with society, they took its findings, they exploited its findings vis-a-vis the Torah. In 1853, the aforementioned Zacharia Frankel founded the Breslau Rabbinical Seminary. He was the chief rabbi of Breslau, and he created something that was called the Positive Historical School, meaning he saw Torah as historically evolving, but he had a positive attitude towards tradition, unlike, say, Reform. part of the evolution was dispensing with basic halachic norms. So if you think about a rabbinical seminary, there their students carried on Shabbos, they drank wine, the stamyenom, their wives didn't cover their hair, meaning they took items of the halacha that are not explicit in the Torah or midrabanan, and they said, we don't do this anymore. Why should we have to follow it? The times have changed. Many of their graduates eventually went to the Reform Seminary for ordination because it was a natural progression. Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, of course, was the Rav in Frankfurt of the Orthodox community, strenuously opposed scientific Judaism. Reform wrote voluminous articles against both, but he was almost an individual in opposing Frankel. Many people did not see Frankel as a danger. Rav Hirsch did. You see, the way they analyzed it, I mean, there's so many problems for Jews in Europe then anyway, in the 19th century, as there are today, but the biggest problem, everyone said, was Reform, because they're denying everything. Frankel wasn't denying everything, and Frankel himself opposed Reform. But Rav Hirsch saw in Frankel's approach an equal danger, because what he was doing was trifling with the idea of Torah Misinai. Once you reject the idea that the Torah came from God to the Jewish people, then it's a free-for-all. Then anything you do or want to do is essentially a matter of choice without any consequences, and you can construct or deconstruct your religion as you see fit. Not just that Torah min ha-shamayim, that God said, Anocha Hashem Elokecha, but what other fundamental principle exists that defines the Torah Jew? It's the uniformity of the Torah Shebichsav and the Torah Shebaal Peh. So many people have this misconception that the Torah Shebaal Peh arose when the Mishnah was published in the year 200, or the Talmud was published in the year 475 of the Common Era. It's a terrible misconception. We maintain Torah Misinai doesn't mean the five books of the Torah. Moshe kibel Torah Misinai u'misorah Yoshua, Yoshua l'zkenim, the Mesorah came from Sinai. Moshe kibel Torah Misinai, we all got the Torah from Sinai. So obviously the Mishnah is talking about Torah Shebaal Peh, not Torah Shebichsav. That was a major war in the 19th century, to the extent that there are four major perushim, or three and one in the 20th, four major perushim on the Torah that arose simply to show the uniformity of the Torah Shebaal Peh and the Torah Shebichsav. Can you name them? For a special prize I have right here. Can you name them? Which four perushim on the Chumash? If I say it, I will keep it. Yes. Which four perushim on the Torah arose 19th century and thereafter to show the uniformity of the Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebaal Peh? Well, the first you'll know, I mentioned, Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch wrote his Perush on the Chumash to show that the Torah Shebaal Peh is part and parcel of the Torah Shebichsav. I'll give you a classic example. From where do we derive the laws of Shechita? The Pasuk says in Parshat Re'eh, Vizavachta, Kasher Tziviticha. You'll slaughter as I have commanded you, Moshe says. Where did Moshe give the command? He didn't. It's not in the Torah Shebichtav. It's only the Torah Shebaal Peh, Kasher Tziviticha. Without the Torah Shebaal Peh, we have no idea what Totafot are. No idea what Pre-Eitz Hadar is. No idea what Malacha is. The Torah will be incomprehensible unless it came with a Torah Shebaal Peh. The first was Rav Hirsch. The second was the Parish of the Malbim. The third was Haktav HaKabbalah of Rav Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg. Note the name. Haktav, the writing. HaKabbalah, the tradition. And the fourth came later, 20th century, which was the Torah Tmima. The Torah Tmima literally lists the Torah Shebaal Peh on the Psukim to show their interconnection. What's that? I get to keep the prize. It has my name on anyway, so just as well. There is a famous Jewish historian, very controversial, not admired at all by Torah Jews, named Heinrich Gretz. Ever hear of his book? It's a master, a multi-volume set on the history of the Jews. So he taught at this Breslau Seminary. He himself was a proponent of scientific Judaism, and he claimed that the Torah Shebaal Peh did not originate at Sinai, but rather it was created by the Chachmei HaTalmud in order to reinforce their views on political and religious questions of their time. So you have to, he's an Amoritz, but that idea still exists. Essentially, he was saying that their conclusions are completely subjective. It's a product of their own individual psychological makeup and political motives. So if a particular Tana said, Asur, maybe he had a bad day, he was unhappy at home, and so he was angry, and he said, oh, you can't do it. It's that type of philosophy that, it should surprise you, many Jews until today believe. That they just all made it up, depends on how they feel. Beit Hillel favored the common person. Shammai favored the wealthy aristocrats. Yeah, it's great until you get into Taharot, into Chagiga, into so many things, where that type of breakdown is ludicrous because it's unrelated to the facts before them. Nonetheless, this took root, and this really was the very foundation of the positive historical school and later the conservative movement as well. Yeshiva of Soloveitchik, notwithstanding that there are people today, even on the leftist fringe of Orthodoxy, who maintain the same things and write books accordingly, Rav Soloveitchik maintained that such an approach is kfira. To say that a Tana, an Amora, a Rishon for that matter, said X or Y because he's in a good mood, a bad mood, he liked people, didn't like people, etc., that's kfira. And the Rav said this from Rabbi Chait, the Rav said that is what the Rambam calls makhish magideha. Makhish magideh. So literally it means they deny the authors of the Torah Shebaal Peh, but note the word makhish. What Masechta learning here, by the way? Baba, so you wouldn't get it, but in Baba Kama you have, in parts of Baba Metzia, you have this Indian of you borrow a cow, and you return. Hikhisha. What does hikhisha mean? Thinned out. Thinned out. Made it thinner, weaker. Machish Magideo, the Rav said, means you thin out the Magidim, the Balei Amasora, and you say that there's nothing objective to it. There's no system. There's no nomenclature. There's no methodology. It's all a matter of feelings. You're Machish them. There the Rambam says in Hilchos Tshuva, Ein lo chelek leolam haba. Now, Gretz devoted a substantial portion of volume 4 of his magisterial history of the Jews to a description of how each psak of the Tanoim was just an outgrowth of their personalities. Rav Hirsch, there's a whole set called Collected Writings of Rav Hirsch. Most of volume 5 is dedicated to a refutation of Gretz. And he said he demolished them intellectually, and he showed not only that it's false, but that it's ludicrous, and it's based on a misunderstanding of halacha and a desire to further a political agenda. Now, Hirsch took the same approach. Of course, he wasn't just polemical. He was definitive, categorical. Frankel wrote a book called Darkei HaMishnah. And there he denied the Torah Shebaal Peh, but he did it in a very, he denied Torah Misinai, but he did it in a very subtle way. And he proposed the notion that laws evolve and that people of each generation have the right to decide by their observance which laws they're going and or not going to follow. So he says, for example, just as Rebbe's Beit Din decreed against Shemen Akum, all right? What happened to that gzera?
Oh, they
didn't like. There he goes. Gemara says Avodah. They couldn't abide by it. Rov atzibur einim chol lamod ba. So it never took effect. So he said the same thing. If in a generation Jews they can't wear a yarmulke, or they can't learn or read Hebrew, so those also lapse, and they're not going to apply anymore. Each generation has the right to whittle down or to conform the halacha, the Mesorah, to what they're able to do. So in the Darkei HaMishnah, Frankel denied the Mesorah as we know it, but he did it in a very subtle way. Rav Hirsch took up his pen and he exposed each error. At no point did Frankel write that the Mesorah or the Yud Gimel Midot, the Torah and the Dreshet Bahem, are Misina. He didn't write that. He didn't deny it either. He said the many halachot of great antiquity. Great antiquity is not the same as saying they're Misinai. Frankel never responded to what Hirsch had to say. Others did, insufficiently. Rav Hirsch said about the book Darkei HaMishnah that you could study the whole book and not be aided in understanding even one Mishnah. Rav Hildesheimer, who was Rav Hirsch's counterpart in some sense, said Breslau does with silk gloves what the reformist Geiger does with a sledgehammer. Meaning Geiger openly denied the Mesorah. Took a sledgehammer to it. Bang. Frankel didn't take a sledgehammer. He sort of chipped away at its foundation and say, well, we don't know. It evolves. And ongoing, what the conservatives will later call a continuous revelation, an ongoing revelation. Solomon Schechter, who became the chancellor of JTS in 1902, said, in fact, that the Breslau Seminary is the forerunner of JTS and Frankel the progenitor. And to see where there is this continuum, Schechter believed in something he called Catholic Israel. Not that we're Catholics.
No, but like mixture, right?
Catholic meaning inclusive, a whole. But his belief was that halacha evolves based on the behavior of the people. So what the people can do, they do. What they can't do, so that the halachic system has to drop. Right, so your question is that you see many times in the Torah and Tanakh, Jews succumb to idolatry, Tavod Azarah. Or other sins, Arayot, other sins as well, right. So I mean, according to him, why would we maintain those? You have to ask him that question. It's a flaw in the argument, all right? Because you could say the same thing, I mean, so Gemara, just to follow your point, the Gemara says that the Sanhedrin exiled itself from the Lishkat HaGozit 40 years before the Churban, so as not to have to adjudicate capital cases. Nefishei Rotzchim. There are too many homicides in the land of Israel. So because there are too many homicides, you'll say, hey, it must be mutter, permitted, because that's what people are doing. Of course not. Your point's well taken. Yeah. Started with the Darabanan. But keep in mind that because the Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebichtav so intertwined, eventually you start imposing on the Doraita as well. And you'll take the simple case of Shabbat, Shmirat Shabbat, Shabbos observance. All right? Very few malachot are referred to in the Torah. It's funny that the one that is referred to, Lo Tavar Eish, not to kindle any fire. So that became the one that they eventually renounced in terms of cars and electricity on Shabbat in the home, etc. What's that? Right, so then, right. Yeah, cars are a little harder because you are igniting, you are burning fuel, so, all right. So what are the American roots of this movement? Yes. It's never in a halachic vein. Yeah. There are certain scientific conclusions that are incorrect in the Talmud, but they never affect halacha.
What about like the fish
and
meat? Isn't that a thing?
That's sakana.
Yeah.
Right. So again, sakana is going to be dependent on what a generation perceives as sakana.
So
all right?
I mean, nowadays, you know, there's no sakana.
There are people who make that argument, credible people. Can't say they're wrong either, all right? Because you see, fish and meat, so people have a hang-up about. But there are other things, leaving water overnight, for example. Other things that, because the sakana is not prevalent anymore, we're not chashash for them. But that's because the operative category is sakana. In other words, it's not the fish or the meat in combination. By the way, Sardim don't eat fish and dairy together for the same reason, but I think that's also, you know, changing over time. Because there the category is sakana and not the individual entities. So once you decree what the sakana is, if it's there, you have to follow. It's not there, you don't have to follow. And you can have other things that are perceived as sakana that you can't do. That's why a lot of the Acharonim, not everyone of course, but a lot of the Acharonim ban smoking. Dangerous, all right? Even though you go back a couple of centuries, I was just learning this yesterday, you go back a couple of centuries, you see, I was learning yesterday the laws of bracha, and the question, do you make a bracha on smoking, all right? Even a birchat hareach, okay? So you have already, the Pnei Yeshua said, nah, because people did it for health reasons. So maybe you should, maybe you shouldn't. Or Chashuchan, he said, people hate smoke, so you can't say it, but nonetheless, you saw going back to the Pnei Yeshua's time, Rabbi Yaakov Emden's time, they thought that cigarette, that tobacco was healthy, all right? Now we seem to think that it's not healthy, all right? I agree to that. So you have to apply the category of sakana to the sakanot that now exist. That will vary because the essence doesn't change. The category, sakana, it's just the details and applications are going to change. You should know, by the way, the examples that are always used, I've had these discussions with people for decades already, they'll say to me, yeah, what about Prusbel? That's the most famous one. Prusbel. It's a Prusbel that your debt, your loans are not forgiven by the end of the Shemitah year. Oh, you have to make a Prusbel this coming Elul, the Shemitah year coming up. The loans, Torah says all loans are waived, unless it's on a Prusbel. But what we don't understand is that even before Prusbel was adopted, when Hillel enacted a Prusbel, he was just basing himself on the concept of Moshe Shtaratov Lebeitin. So that always existed. He didn't make that up. If a person, any lender, gave his shtar to Beitin and delegated recovery of the debt, so the Shemitah never canceled that. Or someone said to me once, so what about Hakafot? You know, Simchat Torah, Hakafot.
What about
Hakafot? Yeah, so Hakafot of Simchat Torah are just an extension of the Hakafot of Sukkah. It's nothing new. An extension, yes, it's new. I mean, I don't know when it started, but the whole Sukkah, we walk around with the Dalet Minim, and Simchat Torah, walk around the Torah. All right. Or actually, we walk around the Torah. Yes. Whoever wanted to talk. And we have these examples, but if you get down into the details, you see they're not changes. They're just the way the Torah is applied in new situations. So you're not going to say, for example, how we deal with technology, the internet, is something that, you know, Shabbos is not involved because it didn't exist in the time of the Talmud or at Sinai. It's preposterous because we have the methodology and we have the formula. We just have to apply it properly. Yes?
What about looking for people's mail and polygamy? Like, where are those, like, is that, like, connected to anything?
You mean the Takanot Rabbeinu Gershon, not to read through a person's mail?
Yeah.
Right. So, if you go to the Talmud, you see, for example, in Sanhedrin, it speaks about keeping secrets, all right? And even in Baba Batra, the right of privacy that people have. So, particular application may not have existed then, because there was no mail service. But all he did was take a good midah, all right, privacy, and then apparently there was a specific reason why it had to be done then and make it a cherem. You know the reason why. All right, off the top of my head, I haven't looked in many years, because Jews at the time became major traders between continents. It's a very interesting thing. You know what letters of credit are? Letters of credit are, I pay for something with a guarantee that someone else will be responsible for the debt if I can't pay it. All right? But in the ancient world, only Jews could do that because there were Jews in Spain and Jews in Bavel and Jews in, you know, Germany and Jews in Israel. So if you knew each other, you could have at the other end someone guarantee a debt based on your word. But they didn't want people, you know, entering, opening the mail of others to see what deals are being done, what money's being sent, etc. So that's where the cherem, that's what I seem to recall, that's where the cherem arose. In any event, how did it come to America? Well, spiritual life in America in the 19th century was a bit chaotic. Not many Jews relatively there. The early Jews, I think we discussed, were mainly Sephardic Jews, and then German Reform Jews began coming in the mid-19th century. But nonetheless, there was no formal Jewish structure. Ish hayashar be'enov yaseh. Along with the positive historical school, there arose a similar-sounding school called historical Judaism. And that was very, very analogous to what was going on in Breslau as well. This movement opposed Reform, and it cooperated with it as well. And you found in the 19th century especially, there was a great spillover, because there was no breakdown of Jews into different, today they say, streams. They were just Jews. The only real breakdown that existed was between Sephardic Jews and Ashkenazic Jews. So you had, for example, proponents of historical Judaism on the right, who were closely affiliated with the nascent Orthodox Jewish movement. One of them was Henry Pereira Mendez, who was a Rav in Yorkshire, Israel, the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue. Very traditional. If you think about it, because it'll shake you. You've all heard of JTS, Jewish Theological Seminary, yeah, the conservative rabbinical school. Well, Rabbi Mendez, who's the Rav of the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, he was a co-founder of the JTS. It was meant to be an Orthodox rabbinical school, the first, we'll see why in a moment, but not like a traditional European yeshiva. He also became one of the founders of the OU, to show you how these things worked back then. Others of this historical Judaism school were much more closely aligned with Reform, like Benjamin Zold, whose daughter you may have heard of, Henrietta Zold, the founder of Hadassah, or someone you might know also, Marcus Jastrow. Have you heard of him?
Yes.
Of dictionary fame. So he was also part of the historical Judaism school, but he was much closer to Reform. They were both rabbis in their own right, and because there was this amalgamation of all Jews, for the most, and there were very few European rabbanim, some very few, and certainly influential, they all took part in the opening of the Hebrew Union College. Now, what they decided, more or less, on an ad hoc basis, that each shul would follow whatever minhagim it wanted to follow, and it was the province of the rabbi. So Zold and Jastrow took out their mechitzot. Zold instituted in his shul a triennial cycle of Torah reading, which today, by the way, is still the norm in Reform and conservative circles. They just read a third of the Sedra every Shabbat, so they finish the whole Torah every 3 years. Jastrow, in fact, abolished Aliyot when he realized that not enough of his members read Hebrew. In 1883, you had a major watershed moment in Jewish life. What was that? Yeah. Yeah, we wouldn't call seven. What's that? I know, they're doing that now also. Yeah, but you lose it on the Mishnah Berachs and all the money that's coming in. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. So in 1883, you had really a major turning point in Jewish life in America. It was, it's known to this day as the Treifa Banquet. You ever hear of it? It was the No. It was July 11th, 1883. It was the first graduation ceremony of the ordainees of the Reform Hebrew Union College. It took place in Cincinnati. I brought for your pleasure the menu. So among the things on the menu, little neck clams, trife. The fillet of beef was also trife. Soft shell crabs, frog's legs, in cream no less. And then a bunch of other things. I guess they had salads too. and then they had dairy ice cream at the end. They served everything but pork. It's like a potpourri, a smorgasbord of every popular tray food except for pork. Well, when the dinner was served, you had some religious people there also, rabbis. They got up and walked out. And that became the major break in Judaism, and it really spawned two movements, if you think about it. And of course, all these things were more concretized in 1885 with the Reform Pittsburgh Platform, in which they codified a rejection of Halacha and Torah, Mashiach and Eretz Yisrael, etc. The break was over five issues. One was over Shabbat, that the more traditional people were opposed to changing it to Sunday. Zold, who had taken out his mechitza, even said, "Kol kofer b'Shabbat, ki kofer b'chol haTorah kula." If you deny Shabbos, you're denying everything. It's moving to Sunday. How could you do that? Kashrut, Reform rejected it. Hebrew is tefillah. Rabbi Mendes said Hebrew is the language of Tanakh. You learn it, all right? Takes a short time to learn. Learn it. Marriage. Reform Judaism abolished a ketubah, gerushin, Isser Kohen with a grusha, gittin, and Eretz Yisrael. They denied Reform that there's any meaning to the restoration of the Jewish people to Tzion, and conservative Judaism, as it developed, always supported Jewish settlement. Well, your question. Yes.
Isn't the feel something that can't be done in any language?
What's that?
To feel like a thing that actually can be done in any language.
It can be. It's true. We discussed this a few times ago. Me'ikar hadin, you can daven in any language. But if you institutionalize it on a communal level, it's a sure recipe for assimilation. Because once you can't read Hebrew, and once Hebrew no longer becomes a language of tefillah or Talmud Torah, what happens then? You stop learning from the sources. And then you start learning from synopses. And then you have nothing. Here's the proof. There's been no Jewish community ever that successfully instituted tefillah in the vernacular and survived.
Also, much of the Greek Jewish communities do that, and I'll say they died from revolting against the Romans instead of assimilation.
The ones who lived in Egypt?
Yeah, like Marcus and Alexandria, but like they would do that and then what killed their community was the fact that...
Did they survive? Are they alive today? No.
I'll say they died because they survive? The Roman swords, not to assimilation.
Whatever. The fact is they were assimilating back then also. You know what the proof is? Right. The proof is that, well, I can't say it's a proof, but how many of you have heard of Philo? I figured you would. Well, he was a Jew, a Jewish philosopher. He was a leader of the community there. But how many of us ever learned the works of Philo? All right? Even you haven't. So the point is, you can't sustain it. Because it's one of the markers of Jewish identity. It's one feature that keeps us bonded to Torah, that we speak that language. That's why it's amazing to think about it, the way Hebrew as a spoken language has been revived. All right, I'm giving lectures on Zionism, as the people say that that Eliezer ben Yehuda revived the Hebrew language. I mean, tell it to Rabbi Kiva Eger. He spoke Hebrew. Tell it to Chavetz Chaim. The Mishnah was written in Hebrew. So he didn't revive it. He revived it as a spoken language to be used every day. But since the Sinai, Hebrew has been the tongue of the Jewish people for religious purposes.
What about when it wasn't, like, say, when the Gemara was written, when we used Aramaic as our tongue for religious purposes?
That was the vernacular, but they davened in Hebrew. They davened in Hebrew. That's a different reason. You have certain tefillot written in Aramaic, Brich Shmei's in Aramaic also. But that's not a change. That has to do with the Gemara says about the Malachim don't understand Aramaic, whatever it is.
So you could understand it.
Whatever, yes.
I don't remember.
Yes, question?
I don't remember.
Okay, so you had an American rabbi named Alexander Kohut, who's also a forerunner of Conservative Judaism. He, in fact, was a co-founder of the JTS. So if you think about it, the Treifa Banquet took place in 1883. Those who got up and left, and others who heard about it, said, we have to ostracize this group because they're completely disconnected from Judaism. And that's when they founded, just 3 years later, 1886, the Jewish Theological Seminary. Now, here were the basic principles. The founders believed in God, and they believed in Torah Shebaal Peh, but the acceptance of the Shulchan Aruch varied. They saw the Torah and the Talmud as the seed beds of the Jewish spirit, but because they were motivated much more by the historical school, they sought development as part of the process, and they held that tradition and Jewish experience must be studied before innovation, so it doesn't vary too much with Jewish legal principle. But that's a loophole you can drive a truck through. Now, obviously, they were motivated as well by the emancipation, by the Enlightenment. They held that Judaism must adapt to changing conditions. And the one that became the most famous, of course, was the Mechitza. In America, even in Europe, in the churches, the Reform had done this, men and women do things together. There's no segregation. So therefore, that's an American thing. Mitzvot are the basic preconditions for the establishment of the Jewish way of life, but you have to be able to tamper at the margins to make it more palatable to people. And the basis for unity of the Jewish people is Klal Yisrael, which in fact we don't believe. The basis for the unity of the Jewish people is Torah, not Klal Yisrael. Any group of Jews could do things that are crazy, that are wrong. But the Torah remains the Torah. Well, for decades, many conservative rabbis were Orthodox by training and by tradition. And it's something that, again, from our perspective today, in 1781, it's quite mind-boggling to think about, that among the founders of JTS were the founders of the OU in 1898. Even more mind-boggling was the ongoing discussion that took place over the course of a few months. Actually, took place over a few years, but came to a head, I think it was 1927, between REITs. It was only in existence over a decade, and JTS, that they should merge. And the merger would be for financial reasons, because they're having a hard time supporting each individual rabbinical school. So there were serious talks, and it fell apart on one issue. One issue. REITs refused to accept the presence of Mordechai Kaplan on the faculty. He's a complete apikoros. And even though he had been one of the rabbis of the Jewish Center, which was an Orthodox shul, until he became a Reconstructionist, started his own movement. But nonetheless, think about how different the world would look. I don't know whether it'd be better or worse, but think about how different the world would look if REITs and JTS had merged in 1927. It's a good novel to write. The conservatives founded the United Synagogue, Rabbinical Assembly, and mainly their intrusions into the world of Torah came about, the aberrations came about, what they call the Law Committee. So sequentially, they got rid of the Mechitza. They changed the ketubah. They permitted in the 1950s, in a very controversial decision, riding to shul on Shabbat. Now note the language that they used. What did I say?
Riding.
I didn't say driving.
Also, what? If you had a goy?
They didn't say a guy. They didn't necessarily say a guy. That's a different thing. Riding, so you're a passenger. You're not really doing anything. But who's going to drive? So eventually it became, some Jew will drive, but others will not. And of course, it was only done for the most prosaic reasons. American Jews were leaving the cities, moving to the suburbs. It's not like, you know, in Brooklyn, you have 10 shtiebels in a two-block radius. Now you had one temple, one synagogue. And not everyone can live within walking distance. No, you had to permit writing. Okay? But I can tell you on experience, seeing it and hearing it, I know of cases where a mother would drive the children to conservative temple Shabbos morning and then drive to the mall. All right, in the car anyway. Once you're permitted driving to shul, because the average member was not so sophisticated to see the distinction between driving and writing, then you just permitted writing and driving for everything, and that's what happened. Obviously, it's going to be followed by permitting electricity, getting rid of muktzah. And then, in the 60s, a heter for kohanim to marry divorcees. And then, of course, by the beginning of the 70s until today, the avalanche of the women's issues, women in a minyan, women as chazanim, women as rabbis, etc. Ein ledavar sof. I guess there is ledavar sof, because at a certain point, you permitted everything. To date, the only aspect of Reform Judaism that conservative Judaism has not adopted is patrilineal descent. There they've maintained that only a Jewish mother can be the source of Jewish identity. Actually, I thought it would pass already, but not. I think what it is almost an identifier. Meaning, once they accept patrilineal descent, then there really is no difference between RJ and CJ. So why do you need, you know, two separate organizations or two separate movements? You might as well merge. That merger issue we'll get back to in a few moments. But it remains today, or it is today, it became a hodgepodge of different groups. Some more traditional Reform. In the past, not so much anymore today, disaffected Orthodox, and Jews who, I think this was the greatest part of the population, Jews who could not observe all the mitzvot, but they didn't want to be looked down upon if they went to a shul. And they embraced really what was a ill-defined catch-all philosophy. Now, in 1988, they sought to remedy this by publishing a pamphlet entitled Emet Vemunah. And I actually wrote, this goes back 30 years, in 1988, a response to it. Emet Vemunah was a statement of principles, but again, very vague and misleading and equivocal. So, for example, is the Torah divine? Well, they say you have two opinions on that, yes and no. Is Mashiach a human being or just an era? Well, you can have two opinions on that. Are the Jewish people the chosen people? So they write, well, they believed that in ancient times. Okay? And if you go, if I can quote, you know, just at random, so what I did is I took their quotes and responded to it because it's language that, here, I'll give you just one. As such, we reject relativism, which denies any objective source of authoritative truth. Others among us conceive of revelation as the continuing discovery through nature and history of truths about God and the world. These truths, always culturally conditioned, are nevertheless seen as God's ultimate purpose for mankind.
What?
Yes. So here's my comment. What's the difference between relativism and truths which are culturally conditioned? It's the same thing. So they're against relativism, but they're in favor of truths that are culturally conditioned. If truth can be culturally conditioned, there's no objective truth. And each generation can create its own truth and moral system. This is precisely the definition of relativism. These semantic contortions are deliberate and calculated attempt to obscure a theological fraud. I wasn't as nice then as I am today. Here, another quote. Every legal system from time to time must adjust what is on the books to be in line with actual practice if the law is to be taken seriously as a guide to conduct. So I said, there's the rub. Halacha is not every legal system. It's a system that came from God, and it just goes on and on. The problem is, you can't be everything to all people. You have no standards. And I think when you start playing with belief in God, with revelation, halacha, mashiach, tchiyat hametim, immortality of the soul, whether galut is good or not, etc., then what happens is you stand for nothing. If you stand for nothing, then you'll fall for everything, as a similar phrase, aphorism goes. And what occurred over time is two things. One, tremendous diminution in adherence to the movement, because you don't really stand for anything. And secondly, blurring the difference, the distinctions between conservative Judaism and Reform Judaism. Now, here's the main problem. They write that the movement sought to create a new Jew. What's the new Jew? One at home in both Jewish and non-Jewish worlds. A Jew willing to observe all the mitzvot and be imbued with the spirit of Jewishness out in the world as well. Well, does that Jew exist? Yeah, he does exist. Who's that Jew? That's the Orthodox Jew. That's exactly what we are. We are Jews who are faithful to Halacha, and we interact with the world. That's what it is. That's exactly what we do. So if the point they're trying to make is that you cannot live in the world without compromising or changing or surrendering certain halachic practices, if you can live in the world and maintain Shabbat, Kashrut, Tefillah, Mechitza, Tara Mishpacha, etc., then why give it up? Why need conservative Judaism? In other words, their vision of the ideal Jew, one who can observe halacha but be in the world, so that exists in our world. It really doesn't exist in their world. So then that is the conundrum in which they find themselves. Their whole argument is now fallacious. So it was true at one time, by the way, because the typical Orthodox Jew in the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s was not really involved in the world that much. Either you sat and learned, or you had some minor profession, and you didn't make a living, and you lost your job every week because you weren't working on Shabbat. And conservatism was seen as, it's a movement that's going to enable a Jew to be at home, both in Judaism and in America. Well, that no longer is the case, so why then do they exist? That became the problem. Over the last decade and a half, many dozens of Reform and Conservative temples have closed because of diminished numbers, and many of them have merged. And one issue that comes about is when temples merge, who's going to win the rabbi sweepstake, the Reform or the Conservative? So that's an ongoing dispute. Just like in Reform, most of their rabbinical candidates today are women. That's a sign of the times. Intermarriage. So that also is a defining element. They still remain opposed to intermarriage. For many years, if a conservative rabbi performed an intermarriage, they'd be banned from the movement. That's starting to change. There's still a ban on performing, but I think it's 3-4 years ago, they permitted conservative rabbis to attend intermarriages, but they can't officiate. But that's not, I mean, that's something, but they also permitted non-Jews to be members of their temples. Meaning, they see as well a similar problem as the one that exists in the Reform movement, that so many of their families are intermarried, the children are intermarried, and if you want to keep them as members, then you have to reach out to non-Jews as well. These days, as I said earlier, it's almost indistinguishable from Reform, but it's important to remember that it didn't start out that way. I believe it wasn't their intention to be today what it turned out to be, but unfortunately that is the result. Are there hardcore conservative Jews who believe in the Shomer Shabbat and Mitzvot in their own way? Yes, they do exist. I knew people in Teaneck who would walk to the conservative temple there. Dafka did not ride. Were they careful every aspect of Shabbat? That I can't say. But it's a very limited number. The number of ideologues, people are conservative Jews because they believe in that ideology, they're very few. And we'll know in our day. We have Jews, God forbid, to go off the derech. You know, anybody who goes off the derech and becomes a conservative Jew or becomes a reformed Jew, no, they become unaffiliated. What's that? Exactly. They become unaffiliated, and maybe they'll feel more at home if they want to go to shul on Yom Kippur in a temple. But nonetheless, it's a real struggle. Notwithstanding all that, I mean, we have to keep in mind that to the extent that they're children of Jewish mothers, they are Jews, and it's a terrible churban in Jewish life that we're losing all these Jews. Whatever anyone can do to bring them back, and I'm not just saying that, you know, because it's the party line. When you're in university, when you're in the workplace, you'll meet other Jews. The best thing we can, Jews who are not religious, not observant, not Orthodox, not affiliated, the best thing that we can do is to present a very friendly, warm, and holy face of Torah. So they'll be attracted to it, and they'll say, this is what I want as well for my children. Okay, until next time, Chag Kasher V'Sameach.